Welcome to the Break the Mold Parking Podcast with myself, Ryan Jackson.
And me, Alistair Finlayson.
And in each episode, we'll be discussing the very latest in parking news and industry insights.
As well as cutting-edge business and thought leadership topics.
So what we found, Steve, is, you know, on previous shows, it's been very structured, whereas we just want it to be a free-flowing conversation, talking about topical subjects. And then, you know, the conversation will obviously branch off in, you know, in different paradigms, but it's just, you know, just making sure we just have a conversation, and, you know, having that openness will allow inspired thought to arise and things that we may not necessarily thought about beforehand. So there is no script. There is no particular structure. It is just having a conversation about what is going on today. And obviously today, the topic of the conversation is the new parking code. So I guess the first and only staged question, or structured question would be, what are your thoughts on the new code, Steve?
It's come as a huge shock. The key point that's come as a huge shock is the amount of the parking charge and what they've done to that. I think the rest of it was pretty much what we wanted. We wanted a single code of practice. That's good for motorists. That's good for landowners. That's good for us. Good for operators. We wanted a single appeal service. We've got that. We wanted there to be a standard setting body because it's about making things better. All of those things have been delivered by government, stuff that we wanted, stuff that we helped them with, actually, with information and what have you. We just think that the amount of the charges is got unintended consequences, is a phrase I've used quite a lot, written all over it. You know, and it's, I just don't think they've fully understood the impact that this is going to have on motorists, stroke consumers, landowners, on raising standards, and on our members. And if I'm honest with you, it's in that order. You know, it's let's take a look at motorists for a start. If we start with motorists, you know, there's going to be a few things going on which government just haven't realised is going to happen. Some car parks that were previously free will have to be charged for, okay? Because quite frankly, car park owners, people who are running car park organisations, are going to lose a load of revenue as a consequence of the reduction in the PCN value. And they're going to need to recoup those losses. And unfortunately, they're going to recoup those losses by, as I say, making free car parks paid for or increasing the parking tariff. And actually, sadly, the people who lose out there are the people who actually are responsible and pay as they go properly. You know, if it's gone from £1 an hour to £2 an hour, their parking fees have doubled. You know, so that's a real challenge. Plus, I think there'll also be a lot of places where the enforcement regime is not viable for any operator to take care of it, and so therefore it won't actually be managed. So basically, it will become a parking free for all, which isn't good news. It's all very well saying, "Oh, it's great, you know, we can just turn up and not bother to pay, and we can do this and we can do that." That's not good news, because actually, the reason people are asked to pay for parking is to pay for the parking facility, to make sure it's got a good surface, make sure it's got good lighting, it's secure, it's safe, that they can leave their car and knowing when they come back, it will still be there and contain all of its contents. They've got a degree of security there. These sort of things go by the wayside if organisations don't or can't invest in their parking estate because of lack of income from other areas. Mm. And I think that's really, really important to understand that. The other thing is deterrent. Having a lack of deterrent is really important, and it's where it's really, really important is where it comes to talk about things like selfish parking and dangerous parking, you know, blocking people in to a certain extent, or parking in an entrance way, or parking in a place that's dangerous, parking where pedestrians are crossing within a car park location. It's not just about overstays, it's about selfish and dangerous parking. And of course, the reducing deterrent makes those propensities more likely. That's got to be borne in mind by government as we proceed this forward. And you've also got a situation where, you know, some landowners may seek to place some fairly significant tariffs on the parking facility. It's quite simply to deter people from doing things which are perfectly, well, I wouldn't say perfectly understandable, but people are quite clever in some of the things they do. Let me give you an example. There's a Sainsbury's right next to Haywards Heath Station. They manage their parking. There's a standard tariff there for an overstay of £100 reduced to £60, give or take. Haywards Heath Station is 10 minutes away from Gatwick. you can see a situation where people may abuse the Sainsbury's car park or the Waitrose car park that's there, overstay for a couple of days or whatever it might be, and only really have to pick up a £25 charge as a consequence. That's fundamentally wrong.
And that's actually very cheap airport parking.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And yeah, I'm not having a go here at Sainsbury's or Waitrose and whatever. Sorry?
Sounds like it, Steve.
Well, I'm not actually, because the reality is...
weekly shop at Sainsbury's, doesn't he?
Well, yeah. No, yeah, I want my special discount. But the most important thing is they need to keep their car parking spaces open for their shoppers. That's what they've got the spaces for, not for people who've decided to avoid paying an airport parking charge and then popping up on a train. It's these sort of live examples that could happen. They're unintended consequences of what government have put forward. So yeah, it's a real problem. And these are problems that motorists are going to face. Okay. I'll give you another example. You've got a situation where actually outside of London, they have reduced the deterrent for abuse of accessible bays. So bays set aside for people with mobility problems. Currently, it's £100 reduced to 60. But what government have done outside of London here is gone from £100 reduced to 50. Because let's face it, the discounted level is the primary deterrent. Over 80% of the PCNs paid are paid at the discounted level. So actually they've moved, as I say, they've moved that from 60 to 50. They've reduced it significantly. And what does that mean? I think it can mean only one thing, that more people are going to chance their arm and seek to park in an accessible bay when they're not entitled to one. And the knock-on effect there is, if all of the accessible bays are filled up when a motorist in a wheelchair drives into the car park, they can't park. They can't get out of their car. Their only choice is to go home. And that's a very, very stark choice. Each of the three of us on this call could probably clamber over to the passenger side and squeeze ourselves out. Obviously, not so easy for me at my advanced age. But, you know, we could do that. Someone in a wheelchair can't do that. So, you know, that hasn't been thought through, in my opinion, properly thought through, the impact on those parts of society. You know, the people who desperately need bays that meet their needs. You know, they need a wider space so they get themselves out of the car and into their wheelchair or whatever else it might be. And of course, these bays are placed next to the ultimate destination because people who need them have got mobility issues. It stands to reason. And I just think that reducing the deterrent for that, if anything, I think they should have tripled the deterrent. And that's pretty much happens when Europe, you know, if you park in an accessible bay in Europe, they will throw the book at you and a few more books as well. And I think that's entirely appropriate.
In the industry, it's widely been accepted that, say, that previously the cap on parking charges, say, within the private sector was £100, discounted to £60. But in actuality, we have to relook. It's actually £60. And after 14 days, if they haven't paid, it then goes up to £100.
That's right. Agree?
Yeah. So I just think the £60 is the actual charge, but for whatever reason, it's always been highlighted that the £100 is the deterrent, is the actual the fixed parking charge. But actually, we have to look at the discounted. But I think it's probably the way that we viewed it or the way that we discuss it, where we always look for the high amount to actually be the PCM.
Well, I've got to be honest with you, you've hit the nail squarely on the head there. You know, the higher level is the thing that stops people from behaving inappropriately. Mm. Okay. Mm. The reality is it becomes the £60, because that's if someone does chance their arm and gets caught, they'll pay the lower amount. They'll just go, okay, yeah, fair enough. I did, you know, I got it wrong there. I didn't, you know, I decided not to pay, or I stayed longer than I should. It's a fair cop, to coin a phrase.
This whole new structure as well was inside London, outside London sparks another debate as to where does London end, because depending on who you ask, you will get a different answer. So are we going to see the definition of London start to be skewed a little bit? And being the ever cynic that I am, are people going to start to look for loopholes in that as well?
I think that first and foremost, I'm sure we'll be able to agree a definition of London, and it could well be...
postcode
areas.
Yeah, but then I'm not a London postcode, but I'm a London borough. So that's where you start to get the whole definition of London.
It could, well, if I'm honest with you, I think that there is a mechanism for defining it, and it'll probably have to do with the London boroughs The local authorities in the London area, they utilise London tribunals for their second line appeals. And for people outside of London, they utilise a traffic penalty tribunal. I guess we would probably draw a line along those lines if we had to. But I'm of a mind that actually the London factor should be extended. You know, if we have to have a diversification between London and the rest of the UK, I think we have to have a diversification between other areas where there is significant footfall. So that's the major towns, the cities, etc. Yeah. Plus, of course, those locations that are close to transport hubs because of having specific needs. There is no doubt in my mind that the £25 deterrent is sufficient in Manchester, in Birmingham, in Leeds, Newcastle, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Bristol, Swansea, you know, and if I've missed any cities out that offends anybody, I'm really sorry. but, you know, it's for me, we've got to look at that. We've got to consider that. Parking tariffs in Manchester are on a par with parking tariffs in London. Okay. Parking spaces in city and town centres, in a lot of instances, are at a premium. So therefore, people will take a punt on what they do in terms of not paying or parking where they shouldn't. You know, parking in places where it's inappropriate, dangerous, or just someone else's space, to coin a phrase. And all of those things are selfish and inconsiderate of other users of the car park, other motorists on the road. Responsible motorists, you know, like the three of us, you know, I wouldn't park in someone else's parking bay, but other people are quite happy to do so. And I just find it incredible. I've been in parking for 11 years, and it never ceases to amaze me how people think they've got the right to occupy someone else's property, or more importantly, a bay set aside for somebody with special needs or special requirements. You know, a parent and child bay, for example. There's a reason they've got a parent and child bay. It's not for just someone in a white van to use when they're popping to the cash point. I think just want to take us back to your typical motorist. Okay, the vast majority of motorists will pay where they should and won't park where they shouldn't. And then you've got a group of people who have genuinely made a mistake in whatever way, shape or form it might be, or have some strong mitigation as to why the breach of the parking terms and conditions occurred. And we're looking to pick those up in the appeals charter. And let me give you a couple of examples of how the appeals charter works. So first and foremost, a motorist who is a blue badge holder drives into a car park. They're having a stressful time in whatever way, shape or form it is. They park perfectly appropriately in an accessible bay, get out of the car, go about and do their business. Okay, fine. What they've done, because they're having a bit of a stressful time in whatever way, shape or form it might be, and we can all have days like that, is they just forget to put the blue badge on display. Right now, that would get them a parking ticket because, of course, the attendant is quite rightly patrolling to make sure he or she can protect those bays so they're appropriately used. And the information that he or she has got available when they issue the ticket is there is no blue badge on display. So a ticket is issued. But it's a mistake. It's a mistake, a genuine mistake. And quite frankly, the motorist didn't set out to make that mistake. They may have had their mind on other things or just having a bad day, as I have done with my complete inability to get my words in the right order. And the appeals charter sees that ticket either cancelled. They just have to appeal and supply a copy of the blue badge, either cancelled or reduced to a lower number. Probably cancelled, given it's resolving an accessible bay. There's another situation where a motorist, they've genuinely paid. Okay, but they've keyed in wrong. They have to key their registration number in, and they've made a simple mistake. They've typed a 1 and it should have been an L, or a 0 and it should have been an O. That should be cancelled, and it will be cancelled. It's cancelled in the new in the BPA code, the new code, the current code of the BPA. It's cancelled on that basis. But there's the other example that, you know, I drive into a car park in the wife's car, go and type in my registration number. And of course, I'm in the wife's car. They'll never match that up in a million years, but it's still a mistake. And I've still paid. Our code of practice requires that's reduced to £20. Fair enough. I've made a mistake. I've got to pay for my mistake, but I shouldn't be paying £60 or £100 for that mistake. We're in parking management, not mistake punishment. And I've said that countless times. And, you know, going back to what I was saying, and the third type of the motorist there. It's the motorist who actually is just going to flout the rules anyway. Okay, so he or she doesn't want to pay, so they're going to try and get away with it. He or she wants to park where they like because they think they've got a divine right to do so. Quite frankly, they need to be deterred from behaving in a way that's inappropriate, not helpful to other motorists and car park users, isn't playing the game as far as the community is concerned. But I thought the trouble is, of course, in reducing the deterrent, we give more license for people like that to behave in the way they want to behave than when the deterrent's in place. Mm. So, yeah.
You've sparked quite a few sort of talking points there, really. I think the first thing was referencing London and elsewhere because, and sort of talking about major cities, you know, if you look at what the other big cities in the country are doing, they're also mirroring what London's doing. If we look at like emission zones, the ULEZ or whatever it's referred to, you know, they're stretching out to Bristol, Bath, Newcastle, Manchester, etc. So why should the parking charges be so different? The big thing from my perspective is the whole point of the new code, on my understanding, is just to give it, to make a lot more transparency and make things simpler for motorists. But what this is actually doing is it's making it more confusing for everyone, because depending on where you've parked within a car park, you're going to get charged differently. Depending on where you are in the country, you're going to get charged differently. So from the whole motorist understanding what the hell is going on with the industry, they're going to look at the sign and we're going to have like a Bible's worth of text to say, if you do this, you're going to be a parking charge of this. If you do that, you're going to get a parking charge of that. If you've not paid this tariff and that's more than the parking, it's just a minefield now, in my opinion. Whereas having just set, if you break the rules, it's this much. If you don't pay it after this length of time, it goes up to that much. So from that standpoint, it's confusing for the motorist, because the whole point of having one code, one appeals charter, is supposed to simplify the process. But by simplifying it, you've now made it even more complicated. And not just that, it's now also for the people that, you know, the tech guys of the industry that deal with the back office side of things. They now need to do a hell of a lot of development work between now and when it goes live, determining for the system to auto-generate the charge based on contravention, and then throw geolocation into that, and then also throw in every PCM where there's like a pan display car park. If the tariff, for whatever reason, is, you know, they've stayed for 12 hours and the tariff would be 80 quid, but they're outside of London and the parking charge would be 25 quid. Well, because the outstanding fee is high, you're allowed to charge that. So there's so many calculations that now have to go on just for issuing a parking charge.
That's definitely an unintended consequence and implication for the sector, 100%. I totally agree.
Because we've been wrestling with it internally. We're sort of looking at all of the different rates and, okay, well, what contravention would this fall under? Because it's sort of a bit of a grey area. You know, would that be the lower amount or would that be the higher amount? Because it's yeah, there's a lot of grey areas, basically.
Yeah, I think that the industry will need granularity in terms of guidance from ourselves and the ATAs. You know, our members will need, the BPA members will need guidance from us. IPC members will need guidance from them, and we need a bit of guidance from government. Is exactly what will fall, what will fall where, and we'll be seeking that.
I think government need a bit of guidance, don't they?
Well, to be fair, let's be clear. We're working with government on this. We've worked with government for 2 years on this, Ryan, I'm very disappointed with the decision they've reached. I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong for the reasons we've outlined. But I do agree with the sentiments that have been expressed in terms of the raising of the standards. And so, you know, I was on Radio 4 Moneybox last week. I applaud 7/8 of what they've come up with in this stuff, because I probably put a lot of it in. You know, it was BPA people who invented the appeals charter and put that in. It's other things we've campaigned and lobbied on for many years, because it's the correct next stage for the parking sector, for how we can progress as an industry, as a sector.
But my take on it has been that actually the private parking sector is probably leading the way in standards. When you compare it to like on-street parking, some of the shenanigans, I don't even use that term, but it's relevant for what I'm talking about. Some of the incidents that I've seen, you know, by public traffic CEOs or traffic wardens, or whatever you want to refer to them as, has been diabolical, and we could never get away with it within the private sector. So we're talking about raising standards, but apart from maybe one or two incidents, I don't think there was much to raise. I think the BPA has done an amazing job, and the IPC as well. Let's give them a bit of credit. I think an amazing job in you know, helping the industry to evolve and to grow and to deliver to an exceptional standard. So I don't think there's much within this that has raised standards, if I'm honest, because a lot of this has been covered already. So, you know, what is it that they've really done apart from, in some regard, decimating an industry? Because from my perspective as a business owner, you know, we're now seeing the fallout, depending on obviously what happens over the space of the next 6 or 7 months. This decision, this new parking code, could actually destroy the industry as a whole. Most operators are just really hanging on by the teeth because retail's been affected, leisure's been affected. Most industries where we operate in, healthcare, has been affected. And as a consequence, we can't operate to the same levels. Now, I appreciate this is generally happening across business as a whole, but given that we've now been this news has now landed, you know, I think it's a rocky road for the industry as a whole. And I don't know what's going to happen over the next year or so. If we find ourselves in another lockdown, because it's going to be unviable for businesses to operate. The only thing we can do is probably come up with new models. Yeah, so come away from an enforcement model over to a management. But at the same time, the management model works, because if an operator is not receiving the income, then it's going to be the landowner that's going to be receiving the income. So if there is no income to receive, then it makes the management model unviable. So I don't know where that then leaves us. So,
and the other thing as well is, not only, you know, I think the timing of it as well couldn't be worse, because as Ryan refers to this, it's talking about management models, you know, businesses that have been closed for, well, over a year now, realistically. You know, I know pubs and restaurants had a few months of opening in the summer of last year, but if they're going to start trying to turn their car park into a revenue stream, they're not going to want to share the pie, because they're hanging on for dear life themselves. So everyone's going to be looking out for themselves, realistically, because parking operators are going to need to hang on. You know, the car parks that operators manage, the business behind that car park, they're going to want to hang on. And so where does that money come from?
People who are managing car parks, running car parks, are going to seek to recoup the income lost from parking charge issued. In some other way, and that is likely, as I say, to increase the tariff or make free car parks go paid for in whatever way, shape or form. Or even if it's just, if they can't make some money out of the car park, they're going to put another 2p on the pint of beer in the pub and whatever. You know, there's got to be a loser on this. I think the challenge we've got in terms of the standards is we'd probably reached as far as we could go with self-regulation. Okay, but unfortunately, the MPs' mailbags were still full of complaints about what was going on in the private parking sector, and MPs wanted to do something about it. And I think it's the right of government to do that. You know, that's fine. And also, you know, that going on to the next stage of you know, genesis, to coin a phrase, you know, you sort of go through the various parts of it. It was probably time to have a bit more regulation with a small r, with more people accountable up through a standard setting body and what have you, and to create consistency across the whole industry. I think that's absolutely fine, and we're happy to go with the flow. And to be perfectly honest with you, if they kept the charges as they were, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We'd be having a far different conversation, because all of the rest of it is fine. Right, we can live with that. It's going to be a few code changes and a few things we might not be entirely happy about. But you know what? On balance, we'd probably be okay. But obviously, it's the charges amount that comes into play. Now, picking up on business viability, let's have a chat about that for a while. I absolutely understand that. So there'd be consolidation, which is not good news for our members, for the BPA members, in my opinion. It's not good news for landowners who want to be able to make a choice of the operators that they can select from to manage their car parks and whatever. But I'll give you another instance where standards could decline. And this is where an operator decides to not bother about asking for DVLA data. Okay, so they're issuing tickets to screen and they say, you know what, I'm not going to bother going for data. All I'm going to do is I'm going to put the tickets on the screen. And then I'm just going to take in the money that I get in as a result of paying for those, because actually I haven't got to affect any standards when I do that. I haven't really got to do anything. you know, I can put the smallest signs up. I possibly don't even put any signs up at all, because I'm not responsible for any code of practice or any requirements. I'm outside of the structure on there, and they can do that because the deterrent factor has gone down, the amount of the parking charge has gone down, and people could, you know, they theoretically could put a ticket on the screen for £25. People will pay the £25. Everyone moves on. They don't need to go to DVLA. They don't need to pay the £2.50. It's likely to be more cost effective. And that, you know, that sounds okay. And then it starts to get a little bit worse because all of a sudden, because they're outside of any rules, they can start doing all sorts of things. They could employ bailiffs to go knocking on the door. And I don't mean proper bailiffs. I mean nasty bailiffs to go knocking on people's doors. They can accelerate the charge with no controls at all. They can accelerate the charge as far as they like with that. They could definitely get it to £85 really quickly. And they may be able to take that to court and persuade a court that they can charge the £85 because Beavis covers that. And all of this is outside of any controls. You might say, well, how are they going to get any information? Well, you know, I think to be perfectly honest with you, if I went back to my car and there was a ticket on there for £25, but I thought it was bang out of line that I'd received it, I might do one of two things. A, just go, I can't be bothered, I'll just pay it, it's £25, right? Just get it out of the way. Don't know what I've done wrong, but oh, fair enough. The other thing I might do is challenge it and appeal, and then I'll just give them my address details in doing that. So, you know, that could easily happen. And I think it is people moving outside of any standards. And this is a drop in standards. This is a very, very negative thing. You know, the government's PR people use this phrase about the industry being cowboys, which obviously, you know, I must confess, I absolutely resent. And I have shared my thoughts on that. But, you know, you can't stop certain people in the PR world wanting to grab headlines and what have you. So that's fine. If I'm honest with you, if they want to use the phrase cowboys, in doing what they've done here, there's a whole new set of posse of cowboys coming to town, shall we say, as a result of that. And I really believe that's going to happen. I've seen the maths on it. You know, I've had a couple of people share the maths with me, and I'm looking at thinking, you know what? This can happen in some areas. It won't happen everywhere, and not every operator will do it. But actually, it's only going to take one or two or three. And this
opens the doors for a quantity over quality model. So whereas generally take, if they're going to the DVLA, they're going to make sure that the PCN is bang on, because the DVLA are very strict with who they give data to, is the bottom line. So they're not going to start taking risks with, you know, not having the correct photographic evidence, etc., signage on site, etc. But it just opens the door for someone, just like you say, Walkran, just, you know, slapping tickets on every car in a car park, and then just like, right, let's see how many of that comes good.
You're totally right. And of course, they're outside of any control. And what may happen, you know, they start off, you know, fairly well intentioned. But as people get greedier and greedier, they get better ideas. And all of a sudden, they're doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. You know, hey, here's a for instance, a lot of parking takes place locally. Okay, people park within a few miles of their own home. How about parking operator engages? So see somebody who's overstayed or not paid, and they've got a little chap or a chapess on a moped. The moped follows the motorist home, gets their details. All of a sudden, they've got the address. They've only got a slap. They can then just put something through the door. They could put something through the door there and then. Okay, there's nothing to stop people doing that. And, you know, you've only got to do that 10 times a day, and you've probably paid the salary of the young chap or chapess who is on that moped. It stands to reason. All these things can happen because the amount is so much lower of the actual deterrent, the £25 compared to the £60. Of course, to get the £60, you do need the DVLA data, because some people are going to receive a ticket to screen at £100 reduced to £60 and go, you know what, I ain't paying that. Let's see what they do. And then, of course, the notice to keeper goes out because they've gone to the DVLA. And then, of course, it starts to get serious because something has actually landed on your doormat as opposed to being stuck to your car.
Go on, sorry, Steve. You raised an important point about Beavis. Why do you feel as though the government ignored the ruling and the fact that, you know, £85 is a significant amount that we can charge for a parking charge notice?
A decision by a Secretary of State trumps, unfortunately, a Supreme Court decision. So if it's written in legislation, it trumps it from that point of view. That doesn't mean that we won't continue to use the argument that six Supreme Court judges out of seven found the amount of £85 not unreasonable and not unconscionable. Beavis is definitely in our thoughts. That was really important, but it didn't set the tariff charge, okay? Because we have to also accept the fact that if Beavis had set the tariff charge, we'd all be charging £85 now. And a lot of people are charging £100, so the tariff charge was set there and had been there. But the case was about whether or not it was a penalty, and it was deemed to be, yes, a penalty, but acceptable in terms of the charge being made. So, yeah, the Beavis case is persuasive to hear. It certainly sets precedent in court, without a shadow of doubt. But it doesn't. It's not necessarily going to be the argument that may or may not win the day as we try and persuade government to rethink their plans.
So where do we go from here, Steve? What's the next step for the BPA?
First and foremost, some operators are considering a judicial review of the decision. So that will incur, that means that a letter before claim needs to be sent to the lawyers of the government. And that letter before claim has gone, that's gone off. And that will then start a process which could end up with the decision being reviewed by a judge. Okay, the BPA.
Are you allowed to share what operators are involved in that, or is that?
I think it's probably not something I'd want to share openly.
Okay.
But it's a significant number. It's 7 operators and 6 suppliers to those operators. So it's a reasonable sized number of people that have done that. And I'm alert to that. The BPA is not issuing a judicial review. We feel that isn't what the trade association should do. We believe actually that what we should be doing, and we are doing, is looking to keep dialogue open with the ministry. So I'm seeking to have meetings with MPs. I'm seeking to have meetings with officials. I've had meetings with officials. I'm likely to have a load more to persuade them to a different way of thinking on this. This is not going to be easy. It's going to be a significant challenge to get us to achieve that. We're looking at producing an impact assessment. So we're working with our auditors, Mazars, and I think it's very likely. Well, I know that all the operators within the BPA membership will have received a series of questions that we asked them to help us with. It's a very tight deadline, but the key point is that all of those questions will go to Mazars. I will never see the answers, the individual answers, but I will see the consolidated answers, and that's important. Once we get that research concluded, we will then be able to draw the conclusion of what it tells us, and we'll share that with government. And that's about actually an impact assessment, what's called an impact assessment. It's something that we believe government should have done. Government may say they have done it. Well, they're going to have to prove they've done it, because they haven't been asking the sort of questions of me and people like me that would enable them to get the information to do a proper impact assessment. And so I would be intrigued to find out what they have done. But we'll certainly share our impact assessment with them and let them know what it actually means. We're also seeking to reach out to stakeholders. And so that's fine. Well, sometimes Will Hurley from the IPC and myself are doing that together. Sometimes we're going separately, depending on diaries and depending on who the contact is, you know, how established the relationship is. And I've already spoken to a number of people about this, and we'll continue to do so. And we're reaching out to organisations to elicit that. So letters are going out to people trying to get some meetings in the diaries that we can go and persuade them to do stuff for us. I think it's the other thing we're doing, it's really important, is we're encouraging operators to write to their MPs, and we're also encouraging operators to get landowners to write to MPs. So that's to the Secretary of State, Robert Jenrick MP, as well as their constituency MP. That's really important. All of this is going to have an effect. Have an effect on operators. You know, I'm pretty sure that your organisation will have to look at the number of staff you've got. Okay, so it could be that your organisation and other organisations may be considering making changes. That's a fact of life. That needs to be amplified.
Alistair's gone after next week, Steve.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, to be fair, it's, you know, I thought he'd gone when he wasn't on the call first thing, Ryan. So to be perfectly honest with you. But I think sticking him in another room is a harsh way of doing it. You know, but the thing is, it's important that we alert MPs. So I've had approaches from MPs to talk to me. I will continue to talk to MPs. I've got a meeting set up for next Wednesday. I've got requests in to talk to the Secretary of State himself. I don't think he's going to have a meeting with me. I think he will send.
I thought you had that sort of influence, Steve. What's happening?
Well, I thought I had it as well, to be perfectly honest with you. But you know, so that my magnetic personality has gone down the drain at a vast rate of knots. But no, we got letters going out to the various MPs, and we're seeking to have meetings, and we got assurances we're going to have those meetings. But I think it's always got to be a number of prongs on the approach. Last one, media. So we will take advantage of any opportunities that media represents to us. I was on Radio 4 Money.
Do you think we will get the support from media, given the relationship that we've had with them about the industry?
No. Yes and no. I think that, you know, we've already sent out a number of press releases, and the only thing we've got back from the press releases we've sent out is me on Radio 4 Money Box. Mm. However, it's about getting the message right. OK, so if there is something that we come across that is newsworthy and it enables us to make the point we want to make, and it does actually whet the appetite of the news editor of the various publications, then, you know, then we might get that media coverage. I must admit, I'm leaving all the press stuff in the capable hands of Karen and Dave from our team there, because they are talented at this sort of stuff. And I'm pretty hopeless, if the truth be told. So they'll do that. But they just come to me for quotes and check technical aspects of what I'm saying, and then they wheel me out in front of podcasts and anybody else that wants to see my ugly mug. And quite frankly, you know the best thing that came out of the radio interview from colleagues was it's case proven. I've definitely got a face for radio. So you know.
Ryan that says that about me as well. That's why we don't share the video for the podcast, only the audio.
Yeah. No, but, you know, it's making sure that we, within the BPA towers, it's just making sure that that we utilise the talents of all the people that are there. You know, in terms of, you know, I'm not a wordsmith for writing such stuff, so someone else does that. I'm able to, I think, talk relatively persuasively and coherently about the subject matter, and so I do that. And one of the reasons that they do get me to do it is it's not the first question that is the dangerous one, it's the second one. It's the supplementary question or a question of technical detail, and I know the stuff, I know it intuitively, and I'm able to answer coherently, and that is much more challenging for anyone coming to this relatively cold. Yes, they can prepare their answers to what we would consider to be the first questions. It's the second ones that sometimes cause problems, and I've seen it with other people in media interviews. They've clearly been well prepared. I'm not saying other people necessarily in BPA, it's other people in other industries that I watch it, clearly well prepared for the first obvious two or three questions, and then whammo, something comes out of left field and you just see them melt on the screen, and that's tough, that's hard yards, because there's nothing worse
than being able to think on your feet and be over prepared sometimes and just be locked in thought for a particular line of conversation. So when something, a curveball is thrown, you don't know what to do, you're flustered. And
let's face it,
I've experienced it many times, Steve.
Well, let's face it, the journos do this. It's their job. You know, their job is to throw those curveballs. And I haven't got a problem with it. But the trouble is with a curveball, you don't know which curve it's going to come from. You know, if you want to take the baseball analogy, I don't think I'd be clueless at baseball with all these curveballs and whatever. But, you know, for me, it's just that ability, having the knowledge that I've got means I've got a better chance of being able to think on my feet and just rely on some of the experiences I've had in the air. And the other trick I've learned as well, which is great, is to actually not answer the question and actually give them the answer that I want to give them. And I think I've...
A true politician.
Well, you know, it's a real skill. You know, thank you for asking this question, but I'm going to give you the answer I want to give you, which is nothing.
It is a skill.
Which doesn't relate at all to the answer you're thinking I would give you. And, you know, that's worked out quite well. And that's about preparation. That's just making sure you've got your messages, you know, because the ideal thing about the radio style interviews, and certainly, you know, in the TV stuff I did, I was at home and I had all my notes next to me. So I was prepped up. And so quite frankly, I knew my messages and I was going to bring those messages in come hell or high water. Right. And quite frankly, I did. So anyway, in terms of media, we're going to continue pushing the media stuff. I think it supports that supports the other prongs. And all of a sudden, you know, I don't know, a persuasive media item written by one of the team gets published, and all of a sudden somebody at MHCLG goes, ooh, we probably should talk to the BPA about that, because that's a very fair point. We haven't thought of that before, or whatever it might be. Now, I don't know what that nugget is, by the way, but if we find it, we're going to go with it as fast as we can. But if that creates dialogue and creates debate and creates an opportunity for us to have a discussion, we will do that without a shadow of a doubt. You know, we're not giving up on this at all, okay, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, we've got the plan A is to get the decision reversed. The plan B is to try and work on the decision and get it amended in some way, shape or form. And we've already talked about some of those adaptations previously on the call, you know, extending the London factor to other parts of the country. Mm. You know, what about charges for people, you know, for what we would loosely describe as repeat offenders? So those people who routinely abuse parking facilities, why should they continue to get, if I say, the benefits of a £25 deterrent? Surely there should be a charge for something of a greater charge for people who continually park inappropriately. What about the elements of the overstays and stuff like that? An overstay of 30 minutes, let's say, okay, is one thing. An overstay of 5 or 6 hours is another thing, okay? An overstay of 30 minutes, there's probably a good reason why. An overstay of 5 or 6 hours is they deliberately set out to not stay the distance. And those people are just robbing a space. They're, you know, I don't know if you guys are too young to remember Space Invaders, but this is what these people are. They're Space Invaders.
It was my era, Steve.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you, Ryan.
I was a pro on Space Invaders.
Yeah, great times.
That sort of triggers, you know, the whole point of the whole loophole that was alluded to earlier. We talk about overstays and you make the example of, you know, 30 minutes and 5 hours. You know, is there anything stopping someone from saying, let's take a retail park where it would be traditionally, you know, 3 hours or 2 hours free parking and that's it, off your plod, you can't stay longer. Now, obviously, outside of London, it'd be 25 quid up to 50 after 14 days.
Yeah.
Is there anything stopping someone from saying, okay, well, you're allowed 2 hours, 3 hours, but if you stay here for 4 hours, you now have to pay by like a parking app 300 quid. And then in theory, that's a loophole because they're now paying the higher fee, which is owed, which is actually higher than the maximum that we're currently charging and the new code says we can charge.
In effect, then they would seek to pursue the tariff instead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think, as I see it, there is nothing to stop people doing that as things currently stand. And I don't think it's an unreasonable proposition. To a certain extent, I think the amount you've outlined there is possibly excessive.
Oh, I'm just, you know.
But I think for an example, and it's sometimes worthwhile to exaggerate the example to make the point, which is what you rather skillfully did. Now, for my part, actually, for someone to say free for 2 hours, but the moment you go beyond, you know, the moment you go beyond, let's say an hour over. You are there for it's a tariff charge, and you make it clear on the signs. And if that tariff charge is £100, fine. You know, the people know where they stand. So they're going into the car park and they make a decision based on the signage. The signage says you can stay here for 2 hours as a customer. Now, if you stay beyond 4 hours, there will be a charge that is levied. You will be required to pay a charge. If you don't pay that charge, we will pursue that charge. Okay. I don't think that's an unreasonable proposition. It's about getting the numbers right. Of course, but I think it's you know, and the customer can make their own decision, and they can also make an appeal. You know, if they, you know, for example, you know, let's be honest. So somebody who's gone into this car park where it's free for two, and then it's £100 for 4 hours plus, okay, has a genuine case as to why they stayed the duration that they stayed. Fine, it'll be either dealt with through the appeals charter, or it will be dealt with on the appeal. With the independent appeal service in place. But providing the fail-safe is in place of the ability to appeal, that's fine. I also, you know, for tariff pursuit, there must be the opportunity to appeal, in my opinion, because that makes it fair and equitable. And if we get the numbers right, that's what's going to happen. And somebody might actually say, okay, fair enough, you know, they're right. You know, I did stay 7 hours in that car park. and it's a free car park. I'm only allowed to stay free for 2 hours. Fine. You know, I'll pay the tariff. Now, it might not be as excessive as 100. It could be a lower reasonable amount. And that tariff could increase, of course. You know, if it is multi-days, it becomes more. So it's all of those things. And I think that becomes fair and equitable. And I think the average person, you know, this is the thing that needs to pass the test of the lady or gentleman on the Clapham omnibus, to coin the phrase. What is the test of reasonableness? Well, the test of reasonableness is if it's a car park that's designed for turnover of motorists, so they get 2 hours for nothing, they go into the location, they conduct their business, and they leave within the 2 hours, which 99.567% of people do. Most people do that. We do millions of these every day, motorists. Well, not so many now, but you know, most of us will go into a car park at some point this week and follow the terms and conditions and leave well within the allotted time, and we'll pay where we should. Okay. This is people trying to buck the system. And people trying to buck the system will look at it and go, actually, you know what? I can't stay here. I'm leaving my car here for the day. And it's a 2 hour free car park. I've got to find somewhere else. And in fact, what they might do is they might actually go and find somewhere where they need to pay to park for that duration at about 30 quid or something, which is a standard fee. It just stops them from, as I say, invading spaces that they shouldn't invade.
In the proposal set by the government, there wasn't 100% clarity around appeals and how that's going to be handled. So obviously a popular at the moment is a case whereby if motorists are unhappy with the initial appeal response or the appeal decision, they then have the opportunity to make a second appeal via popular. So would it be the same sort of setup with the single appeal service? And in regards to the charges, if the initial determinant is 25 quid, I think a popular, every popular that is processed, I think the fee's around £27. I could be wrong. Yeah,
that's right. Spot on. Well, it's £26.50, but around £27.
So with that being said, it then makes it uneconomical. So has there been any discussions around what that fee would be for operators, or if it will be on a fee basis, or is it just on a membership basis? How does it work? Do we have any clarity around it?
Okay. Right. So there's a whole raft of stuff there. Let's go straight back right to the start of what you were saying there. So first and foremost, it's my understanding that the government are going to go out to tender, going to seek a procurement for people who could provide the single appeal service. I'm very sure that the ombudsman services who currently provide Poplar under contract with the BPA are likely to bid for that work. Okay, which is good. And there may well be other bidders as well. OK, I think at the moment government are doing a bit of market testing to see what's out there, what the potential models look like that are out there. It's definitely the way to go, in my opinion, it's a principle that everyone seems to find reasonable. And it's also a principle that's mirrored by local authorities. So the first route of appeal is to the person who's issued you with the ticket. So if you get a ticket from a local authority, you appeal to the local authority first. And if they reject your appeal, they give you the opportunity to go somewhere else. And that's what we do, as you know, with Poplar. So if somebody appeals to Gemini you reject the appeal, you're required to give them details of how to go to Poplar. Perfectly fair and equitable, in my opinion. And that would then make its way through the process. And I can't see the actual process itself changing markedly as things stand at the moment. Going back to the charge, I am assured that any charge would be on or around the current charges being levied. Okay. It's also worth noting, two things worth noting. First and foremost is at the moment when things go to Poplar, they go at the higher charge. So it wouldn't go at the £25, it would be going at the 50. I don't see that situation changing at all. And that's certainly what we'll be pushing for. And the other thing to understand, that only 1% of cases go to Poplar across the industry. What we're talking about, 1% of PCNs issued end up at Poplar. So yes, from time to time, you might decide, it could be that certain cases are not cost effective at Poplar, then you would just withdraw them at that point, if that's what you want. And that's a facility that's open to you now. You can withdraw a case from Poplar, providing it's within the first 21 days, and there's no charge for it. So I think that's really important to understand. Yeah. And probably about a quarter of the cases registered at Poplar end up being withdrawn. 0.75% of the total PCNs issued end up at Poplar. And I don't see that changing markedly. In fact, if anything, I think payment rates of the lower tariff may well go up. That isn't supposed to be any comfort, by the way. That's just if it's a lower amount, more people will pay it, you know, because they don't want the aggravation, for want of a better description. If it's 25 quid, it's more likely to be paid. The challenge is, of course, that you've still got the same costs that are being levied on your business. And of course, the profitability factor is the thing here. And by the way, when I say more people will pay, that isn't any way, shape or form to give anyone any comfort. It doesn't give me any comfort at all, because it goes back to what I said, is because more people are paying, it's not an effective deterrent. If people go, fair enough, 25 quid, I'll risk it. Let me show you a little story to finish with. Parking attendant in Bournemouth last summer was approached by a chap and he said, I'm going to park here, mate. And the parking attendant said, well, you can't park there. You're not allowed to park there. He said, well, what are you going to do if I park here? And not particularly aggressive, you know, just what, you know, what is your plan? He said, well, I'm going to issue you with a notice. And the bloke says, so what's the notice amount? He said, well, it'd be £50, but £25 if paid within 14 days. The bloke just turned around and said, that's a fair cop. It's a £25. There's five of us. It's £5 each for a day's parking. We're off to the beach, mate. Fill your boots. And that's not a proper deterrent in my world.
In some places, that's cheaper parking than parking in a proper car park, especially at a location where you're looking to go. You know, I'm not far from Southend, and I know that parking for the whole day there can ramp up quite quickly.
You're absolutely spot on, Alistair. And it's also, people can also park close to the beach in places which are possibly not appropriate. So, hey, you know.
And this is the problem. So hopefully we'll have some movement and we can get that pushback from the government, but I guess it's in the hands of the BPA and in the hands of the gods now. So, Steve,
it's also in the hands of what any operators can do as well. So, any operator listening to this who's able to do anything, it will be hugely appreciated. And if anyone wants to give me a call or send me an email, and I'll arrange a call and talk through some of the options people would have. Mm-hmm. Guys, thank you very much for inviting me on your award-winning podcast.
Come on, Steve, get it right. Award-winning now.
Award-winning.
Yeah. No, sorry. Prestigious award-winning.
Prestigious award-winning podcast. Yeah, yes. I thought it was great. I thought it was great that I only got second place in those awards. But you know, hey,
my friends didn't call the award prestigious when I showed them, but I can't really repeat the words as to what they called it.
They're no class, mate. They've got no class.
No, exactly that. But Steve, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Take care.
Thank you for providing us that insight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
Cheers.
Very
Stay
much.
Stay safe.
And that's it for another episode of Break the Mould, the parking podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show. If you did, tell a friend, tell a colleague, pass the pod. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another special guest. So until then, thank you for listening as we break the mould.